gather around as we take a puff back to the early 90s, where one little puffball started his journey not just through Dreamland, but straight into our hearts. Today we're traveling back to the release of Kirby's Dream Land for the Game Boy, a game that not only introduced the world to one of the cutest video game characters ever, but also set the foundation for a franchise full of heart, heroism, and hunger. In 1992, amidst a bustling era of gaming, Kirby floated onto the scene with his unique ability to suck in foes and copy their abilities, a mechanic that turned the platforming genre on its head. But Kirby's appeal wasn't just his powers, it was his simplicity and the joy that emanated from every corner of Dreamland. As we dive into Kirby's origin and the impact he's had on gamers, let's not forget how this pink puff proved that heroes come in all shapes, sizes, and appetites. So stick with us as we explore how a simple gameplay mechanic evolved into a legacy of fun that continues to inflate our expectations. Today, we're floating through the clouds with Kirby, so join us as we take another trip down memory card lane. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I hope these words find you well. Hello and welcome to the 191st episode of our video game history podcast, A Trip Down Memory Card Lane. Each week, we'll tell you the story relevant to the current week of gaming history. It can be about a game or the people that have created it. It can be about a console or the technology that brought it to life. We often talk about the companies that bring it all together, making our hobby a reality. While teaching you each story, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. Today, we're floating through the charming and whimsical world of Kirby's Dream Land, a game that not only introduced us to one of Nintendo's most enduring characters, but also brought us a new level of creativity and fun to the platforming genre. Released on the Game Boy in 1992, Kirby's debut has since blown up into a significant franchise. I'm David Kasten, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, who might just challenge Kirby for the title of Biggest Inhaler of Snacks. He's my brother, Rob Kasten. Rob, with your snack skills, do you think you'd outlast Kirby in a buffet?
Well, Dave, I think I could take him, although we might just end up calling a truce at the dessert table.
That's a fair statement. Man, I've seen you put it down. I don't know. I think you give him a run for his money.
Yeah, but the sweets is where it gets a little rough, man.
It does. Yeah, it sure does. Literally, if you're a diabetic like me, that'll literally kill you.
Got so, that right.
Hey, actually, my blood sugar is under control, finally in my life. Yay. Next. I'm technically pre-diabetic, I guess. I don't know.
Woo!
So, what's going on this week in gaming history?
Well, 34 years ago on April 21st, 1989, Nintendo expanded the horizons of one of its flagship franchises with the release of Super Mario Land for the Game Boy. Launched in Japan, this game introduced player to Sarasa Land, a new setting outside the Mushroom Kingdom, and Princess Daisy, who made her debut as a character in distress. Unlike its console predecessors, Super Mario Land featured unique gameplay mechanics, including side-scrolling shooter levels. The title not only demonstrated the versatility of Mario as a character, but also the Game Boy's potential to deliver engaging, diverse gameplay experiences in a portable format.
Woo!
Super Mario Land was pivotal in cementing the Game Boy's legacy as a must-have gaming device and showcased Nintendo's ability to innovate within the boundaries of its established series. And we covered it back in episode 35, so go check it out.
Yeah. Whew.
Also 34 years ago, on April 25th, 1989, the iconic beat-em-up game River City Ransom was released. Known for its unique blend of action fighting and RPG elements, the game allowed characters to roam freely through River City, battling gangs and upgrading their characters with food, books, and other items to enhance various stats. River City Ransom stood out for its depth and humor, featuring a detailed cityscape and the ability to use objects from the environment as weapons, which at the time was a novel concept.
Indeed.
And for those interested in a deeper dive into the game's impact and legacy, we covered that back in episode 21. So we encourage our listeners to check out our archives for that episode and explore more about how this game influenced the evolution of the beat-em-up genre and became a beloved classic.
I loved that game. I think I spent a lot of that episode just raving about how much I loved it, playing it when I was a kid. So that's a good one.
Yeah, I think that was back when I still had some time to try out the games, and I remember trying that one. So it was, even now, it was a fun beat-em-up game, you know?
It's a very fun beat-em-up game.
Indeed. Well, Dave, 1989 was an incredibly busy year, because we have an even more pivotal moment yet.
What happened?
Well, on April 26th, 1989,
that's a busy
week. Game Freak. It is. But it's when Game Freak was founded by Satoshi Tajiri and Ken Sugimori. Initially started as a self-published video game magazine, the company evolved into a game development studio. Game Freak is best known for creating the Pokemon series, one of the most successful and beloved video game franchises in history. The studio's innovative approach to gameplay, which combined creature collection with RPG elements, revolutionized the gaming industry and sparked a global phenomenon that includes games, merchandise, movies, and a long-running television series. Their dedication to charming design, engaging game mechanics, and in-depth storytelling has earned Game Freak a special place in the hearts of gamers worldwide. And their creation of Pokemon has not only influenced Kowloon's other games, but also created a cultural legacy that spans generations. And, speaking of the creation of Pokemon, 25 years ago, on April 23rd, 1998, the Pokemon Company was established as a joint venture by Nintendo, Game Freak, and Creatures. This strategic collaboration was formed to manage and expand the Pokemon franchise, which included video games, trading card games, TV series, movies, and a wide array of merchandise. The formation of the Pokemon Company was a pivotal moment in the history of media franchises, allowing for a coordinated effort in brand management and cross-platform expansions. This move was instrumental in globalizing the Pokemon brand, ensuring its growth and sustained popularity across multiple generations and diverse markets. The Pokemon Company's innovative approach to franchise management has set a benchmark in the industry, influencing how intellectual properties are handled in the gaming and entertainment sectors. And for those who want to learn more about the history and impact of the Pokemon Company, we covered it back in episode 57. So check it out to learn more about how this company has shaped the entertainment landscape and continues to innovate within the industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember? I'll never forget my favorite part of that episode.
Do you remember? Jets.
The Jets. The Pokemon, yep. Jets.
Oh, yeah.
I love the Pokemon Jets. Yep. Okay.
Fantastic. It was 23 years ago on April 27, 2000, that Nintendo released The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask for the Nintendo 64. This game was the sixth main installment in the Zelda series and a direct sequel to the highly successful Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. Majora's Mask is distinguished by its use of a 72-hour time cycle, which the player must manipulate through time travel to prevent the moon from destroying the world. Set in the mysterious and haunting land of Termina, Majora's Mask challenged players with its darker themes and more complex storylines compared to its predecessors. The game's innovative use of masks that transform Link into different creatures, each with unique abilities, created a gameplay experience rich in variety and depth. Majora's Mask was critically acclaimed for its graphics, complex puzzles, and immersive storyline, and it remains a cult favorite among Zelda enthusiasts for its distinctive, moody atmosphere and deep narrative.
Don't lie, it's your favorite, isn't it?
I would not say that it's my favorite. I still think that Ocarina of Time is more of a favorite. Maybe that's just because of nostalgia.
Yeah.
I also didn't play Majora's Mask growing up. It was once it was on the DS and I borrowed it from my roommate Kiefer.
Right.
So I can't say it's my favorite, but it was a fantastic game, even on the 3DS. It was fantastic, you know.
Agreed.
They did not miss many. 18 years ago, on April 21st, 2005, Nintendo released Nintendogs for the Nintendo DS. This innovative game introduced players to a virtual pet simulation where they could raise, train, and care for their puppies. Set in a virtual home environment, Nintendogs utilized the DS's touchscreen and microphone features, allowing players to interact with their pets in a highly intuitive and engaging way. The game not only showcased the unique capabilities of the DS, but also expanded the gaming demographic, appealing to a wide range of ages and interests. Nintendogs was pivotal in demonstrating the potential for non-traditional gaming experiences and cemented its legacy as a beloved and best-selling title that would lead to multiple sequels and editions. And Dave, it was 5 years ago on April 23rd, 2018, that Kitten Life Simulator was released, immersing players in the adorable and often humorous daily activities of a young kitten. This simulation game captured the hearts of animal lovers with its realistic graphics, engaging gameplay, and the charming antics of its feline protagonist. Set in a detailed, interactive house environment, players could explore from a kitten's perspective, engaging in playful antics, exploring mysterious nooks, and interacting with various objects and other pets. Kitten Life Simulator not only provided entertainment, but also offered a relaxing and heartwarming virtual pet experience that appealed to both casual gamers and cat enthusiasts alike.
Do you know how much fun it is to write important descriptions for non-important games?
I can only imagine, Dave.
Ooh, I love Kitten Life Simulator. It's my favorite.
I know, Dave. I figured we should let everyone else know what it's about.
It's your kitten playing around in a house, being a cat, being all nimbly, bimbly, and drinking milk out of a saucer.
Yeah, and on that note, Dave, I think we should talk about our topic of the day, so let's shoot on over to that.
Man, so it's been a long time, I think, since we've talked about HAL Laboratories.
Quite a long time.
Yeah, we covered their history pretty early on in the series back in episode 35, and I know we've touched on it in a few episodes since because they've done a lot of work with Nintendo, so no doubt they come up. Per usual, though, I think that historical context is important, so let's talk about HAL leading into the years in which our topic today, Kirby's Dream Land, was made. HAL got its start in 1980. They started out making games for the MSX and VIC-20 systems. But in the mid-80s, just like every other video game studio interested in making money, they jumped on the popularity of Nintendo's Famicom system. And they started working with Nintendo directly. They're responsible for some of the earlier games, not really the Famicom, but when it came to NES, they were part of the re-releases for Famicom, but they helped develop games like Pinball and Golf. I played a ton of Golf on the NES. Balloon Fight, Joust, they brought Millipede over to the NES. So a lot of these like basic ports, are not ports, but games early on in the library came from HAL Labs. Towards the end of the 80s, there was a freelance employee, a manga artist, named Yoshimaru Hoshi. He's best known as an artist named, goes by his first name, Yoshimaru. And he was basically a contract worker that helped out with various projects. None of them really are of note. But one. While he worked on them, he gained a lot of really important experience, and he learned how to push the boundaries of what the Famicom could do graphically. And from his experience, he was able to create character portraits with blinking eyes and mouth animations. And he was using these graphical designs, something that no one had really done before, to prepare a presentation, because all these freelance artists would come together and pitch their ideas to the, you know, the heads up, the bosses at HAL, and with the hopes that one of their pitches was going to be picked up, right? And while he's working on preparing a presentation, he basically has this idea. He wants to create a presentation around one of his mangas that was canceled. So he's trying to develop this graphical presentation to give the team an idea of what he's looking for. When the head of development at Hell, a name that we definitely know, we've talked about him a bunch, Satoru Iwata, he walked by, saw what Yoshimaru was working on, and gave him immediate approval without having to see the rest of the presentation. Turns out he was so impressed with what the guy was able to do graphically on the Famicom that he said, whatever it is, it's got to be great. Have it. Have at it, right? So, essentially, Yoshimaru becomes the game's director. He's the creative vision, right? He writes the script and outlines everything and so on and so forth. Iwata stays on as a producer. We've talked about that before. We know what that means. He was there overseeing things. Although, admittedly, in this case, as a producer, he ended up programming a bunch of this game. But essentially what Yoshimaru Hoshi and the team end up doing is they develop advanced graphical techniques for the Famicom so that the pixel art that they were designing mirrored the manga-style pencil work that Yoshimaru was known for. And they ended up developing a game with it called Metal Slater Glory. Now, Metal Slater Glory ended up... The development on Metal Slater Glory took 4 years. 4 long years. And by all accounts, it ended up being a huge game. You know, if you go back to last week's episode, we learned about memory chips, multi-memory controllers, MMCs. They were added to game cartridges to give the teams more space to work on. Last week, we learned that Fire Emblem had to create theirs. I believe it was MM4. In order to add all the content that they wanted to game. Well, here, this one's actually MM5, and this was added to allow them, again, to have all the space they needed to work with these advanced graphical techniques. This game clocked in at 1 megabyte of data, which by modern means is nothing. You listening to me for the last couple seconds well exceeded that. But that made it the largest game ever produced for the Famicom system. Now, because of the long development time and the added hardware that they had to design and make and so on and so forth, it was easily one of the costliest games ever made for the Nintendo Famicom platform. And on top of that, for whatever reason, Nintendo decided to limit the amount of MMCs that they were going to sell to Hell. So the studio was only able to produce a limited number of what was already a very expensive to produce game. So look, you take the cost of the game, developing it, the long development cycle which added to it, the hardware, you couple that with a lack of sales because they can't make a lot of copies, and you have essentially a gigantic drain on the studio's resources. So much so that the company found itself on the brink of bankruptcy.
Damn.
But luckily, they had been working with Nintendo this whole time, and they had a great relationship with Nintendo. And Nintendo offered to rescue the studio on one condition. And that condition was that this producer, Satoru Iwata, would be appointed president of Hell. And they didn't really have a choice. It was go with Nintendo's demands or go bankrupt. So they accepted the offer, and Hell lived on to develop another day. So while the studio is struggling with Metal Slater Glory, they are still working on other projects, right?
Right.
And in the midst of that, the Nintendo Game Boy gets released in 1989. And no doubt, because again, they're in the business of making money, that Hell wanted a piece of the action. In the midst of all this, there is a relatively new employee, young, 19 years old at the time, a man named Masahiro Sakurai, and he's looking to develop a simple game that could be easy to pick up and play for those that are unfamiliar with action games. And their idea was to design a project tenderly titled Popopo of the Spring Breeze. And they used a simple character placeholder to build the game out. Just a simple, round, no frills, just basic graphic. Because that's what you do when you design a game. We call them programmer's graphics. You don't build your fancy graphics into your initial build of the game. You work your gameplay around programmer's graphics, around blocks and circles, and really basic shapes and placeholders to make sure it works. And then once you know it works, the artists go to work. Sometimes it happens at the same time, but a lot of times then the artists go to work and they make it pretty, right?
Right.
So this is just a character placeholder. And basically, they are designing this game on what's known as a Twin Famicom. Now, the Twin Famicom was a Nintendo licensed console, and it combined the Famicom and the Famicom Disk System, which we covered in our Zelda episode, both in one single piece of hardware. But interestingly enough, little fun fact about this, the Twin Famicom didn't have any keyboard support. So no joke, they wrote this game using a trackball in tandem with an on-screen keyboard. So they're designing this game and they have this simple round shape, and they decided as they kept working that they really liked it. They thought that it was a simple circular design that anyone would be able to draw. It was a blank slate for the player, so to speak. It didn't really convey emotion. They wanted the player to be able to bring emotion to it. It was just simple, cute, and relatable. So they decided that their simple character placeholder that was going to be temporary was what they were going with. And as they continued to design the game, the abilities of their main character, Popopo, really started to take shape. In a 1993 interview, Sakurai said, "I was wondering if I could make a game with simple controls where you would use the enemies to attack. I was thinking of using an enemy the way you would use a soccer ball. Heading the enemy, that's hitting it with your head if you're not a soccer person, the way they, you know, headbutt the ball. Kicking the enemy, and so on and so forth." As part of the same interview, it was done with Sakurai and Iwata. Iwata added, "We came up with a lot of details, and the one that stuck was flying. How would Kirby fly? Popopo ended up being Kirby. We'll talk about that in a moment. By puffing up like a balloon. How would he do that? By inhaling the air. Wouldn't it be fun then if he could inhale enemies at the same time? And this was how we progressed. This was our basic thought process." You know, Sakurai wanted Popopo to fly because he thought it would be unfair for the player to lose a life by missing a jump. So again, back to that whole easy to pick up action game, right?
Right.
They also took inspiration from Yoshi. They knew that they wanted Kirby to have the ability to grab enemies, but instead of using his tongue, they decided, you know, as part of the flying bit, that they would have Kirby inhale the enemies and spit them out instead. So they just kind of worked their way through this process, you know, designing the character and designing the abilities. And eventually what they got was Popopo and just a really simple circular shape, you know, that could fly, that could suck in enemies, that could spit them out. Really simple. At some point, the name of the game was changed to... Originally, it was going to be Popopo of the Spring Breeze, and eventually it was changed to Twinkle Popo. And this name stuck around long enough into development that there is box art design and promotional material design with that name on it.
Wow.
So it was almost going to be Twinkle Popo. It's so
what made them fumble that one, man? That was a great name.
I know. It gets better, the confusion over the name, because it wasn't just the name. You know, when Sakurai designed Kirby, I mean, we know it's Kirby. He drew him as pink from the get-go, right? But the Game Boy is not color. It's a monochrome display. So nobody knew that he was a color or he was pink. Miyamoto famously thought he was yellow. And when Nintendo of America designed the marketing materials over here, the cover art, the box art of this game for the Game Boy has Kirby white because they didn't know any better. There was no color on the Game Boy and no one bothered to tell them that Kirby was pink.
That's fantastic.
But Sakurai's original drawings were pink. He had always intended him to be pink from the get-go. So they're continuing to work on Twinkle Popo, and they're whipping up all these marketing materials because originally HAL envisions themselves, they plan on self-publishing the game. But whenever you go to publish a game, you gauge interest in its popularity by advance orders, right? How many retailers are placing orders for how many of these games? And as they're looking at advance orders, there just was little to no interest in Twinkle Popo, let me tell you. And frankly, they're hurting Metal Slater Glory, right? So they don't have the luxury of failing elsewhere. So they get real hesitant to put their money into it and say, eh. So they basically go to Nintendo and ask Nintendo if they would publish the game instead. Which, of course, Nintendo says yes. They step in, and then, as we learn time and time again, Nintendo does what Nintendo does. They take control. Which was good, because this game got, as part of that process, an extensive marketing campaign. And they decide, as part of that process, when they're looking at marketing, that Twinkle Popo probably doesn't have international appeal, right?
What? How?
I mean, that would have probably fallen flat on its face.
Yeah, that's a pretty terrible name.
Yeah, well, it means something. It means something, but I don't know.
Well, I'm just saying to us.
Yeah,
Kirby is much better of a name, but, you know, clearly won out.
Kirby is a better name. Jeez Louise. So they go and get together a list of potential names, and they poll Nintendo of America with this list. I tried looking for other names that were on the list. I've only found one, which was Gasper, like Casper with a G, Gasper.
Nice.
But what they chose, as we know now, was Kirby. And Kirby was added to the list in honor of American lawyer John Kirby, really famous lawyer. He did civil rights. He did so much civil rights work. But at one point, he defended Nintendo in a court case where Universal Studios sued Nintendo for infringing on the copyright of King Kong because of their use of Donkey Kong.
Oh.
Obviously, because Donkey Kong is still a thing, we know how that court case ended up, right? That was not the case. There was no infringement. The court basically said, we don't think people will confuse one with the other. And Nintendo was allowed to continue using the name Donkey Kong. Little side note to that trial, I you know, hopefully I get to do an episode on it someday. But, you know, after the case was won, Nintendo had known that one of John Kirby's sons was learning to sail, so they gifted the family a 27-foot sailboat christened Donkey Kong, and they granted the lawyer the right to use the name on boats for the rest of his life.
That's fantastic.
They also ended up sending copies of this game to the Kirby family in 1992 when it came out, which just lends more credence to this notion that they knew what they were doing when they chose the name. So, in later interviews, it was said that they also chose this name because they were really amused by how the harsh-sounding name Kirby contrasted with the cute appearance of the character.
Interesting. So, I don't really think it's that harsh sounding of a name.
Kirby? It's got that harsh K, Kirby. Kerr is kind of a harsh consonant.
I don't agree. Sounds pretty smooth to me.
Yeah, The final title of the game when it released in Japan was Hoshino Kirby, which translates to Kirby of the Stars. And of course, we know that when it came out over here to North America, the first game in the Kirby series became Kirby's Dream Land, which of course was released on April 27th, 1992. Rob, have you ever played a Kirby game? Other than Smash Brothers?
I'm trying to think. I don't believe that I have. I don't believe I have.
I'll be honest, I hadn't, but I did take the time to play this game in preparation for this episode because, again, I had never done it before and I felt guilty not having ever played a Kirby game, considering Kirby's been around since 1992. So, the first game in the series is a Game Boy game. It's not a big investment. It's only got five relatively short stages. In fact, you can play through it in 45 minutes to an hour. I played it over the course of a couple lunch breaks this week, split up into two lunch breaks. That's really all it took. So, not a huge investment in any way, shape, or form. It's always crazy to me when we go back to some of these early games. Like, we did this with Super Mario Land 2, where, like, I remember playing these as a kid, and I'm like, oh my god, like, I don't know how I beat it. I got through it. I'm thinking it's the longest game ever. And then you go, like, I looked up the playtime too because, like, I wasn't really paying attention. Like, I knew I played it over two lunches, so I was assuming like an hour, maybe a little bit more. But I went and I looked up like average playtimes online, and it's listed for everyone as 45 minutes to an hour. So, I mean, it's not a long game for any of us. But, like, man, does time, your concept of time change when you're an adult from when you're a kid, you know?
Nah, not at all. It's all the same.
No, it's all the same. But anyways,
no, definitely.
It's not a big investment. It's an hour. Go play it. I mean, you can find it pretty easily. I'm not going to say how, you know, Game Boy games are easy to whatchamacallit, find online to play. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a really simple, easy to pick up platformer. I didn't save scum. I didn't have to cheat. I was able to play through it. I think you start out with five lives, but you can pick up extra lives along the way. It's not that difficult of a game. But that was one of the critiques of this one, to be fair, that even back when, that people said it was pretty easy of a game, so they kind of upped the ante in later games in the series, but no regrets. It was an hour well spent to go back and have a little nostalgic fray into gaming, right? Right.
You got that right, Dave.
And speaking of nostalgia, we love nostalgia, don't we, Rob?
That we do, Dave.
And our love of nostalgia has put us in a position where we like to share our nostalgia with the world. And perhaps you, dear listeners, have something nostalgic or something interesting that you would like to share to the world. And maybe, just maybe, just like us, you're considering making your own podcast, but you really, really don't know where to start. Well, our friends at Zencastr have created an all-in-one podcasting suite of tools that make it easier than ever to create your own podcast.
With Zencastr, it's super easy to record a podcast. Everyone logs in using their web browser, and you just start recording a high-quality podcast right away. It allows you to record up to 4K video with your guests, and with Zencastr's multi-layered backups, you always have the highest quality recordings, even if your connection is unstable.
And with Zencastr, you never have to worry about what you sound like. Zencastr's post-production process always makes you sound buttery smooth. This voice, that's not me, that's Zencastr. It automatically removes all those ums and ahs, removes awkward pauses, you can set the right podcast loudness, reduce background noise, just a bunch of selections. Hit this button, hit that button, hit that button. And then there's a single button that says produce at the bottom, and away you go. You don't have to do anything else. It even emails you when it's done, so you don't have to sit there and watch it do its thing.
And if the thought of podcasting overwhelms you because you think you need tons of different tools and services, relax. Those days are over. With Zencastr's all-in-one podcasting platform, you can create your podcast all in one place and distribute it to Spotify, Apple, and other major destinations.
So if you'd like to start your own podcast, or maybe you already have one and you're looking to take it to the next level, we've got a deal for you. go to zencaster.com/pricing and use our offer code MemoryCardLane, and you'll get 30% off the first month of any Zencaster paid platform.
Sign up for Zencaster today, and you can experience the same ease in producing your own high-quality podcasts as we do each week. Go out, share your ideas with the world.
Rob, how popular would you say Kirby is in your mind?
I would not dismiss Kirby in any way, shape, or form. I would not say on par with, say, like a Mario or a Pikachu, but Kirby's pretty goddamn recognizable.
Kirby is recognizable. Do you know when the last Kirby game was made?
That was just Kirby?
Yeah.
Okay.
The last one that could technically be called a Kirby game. When do you think the last one was made?
Within the last 4 years.
Within the last year.
Oh, damn.
I
did not know there was one that recent.
I mean, they had a remake of Return to Dreamland Deluxe last year, and the main entry in the series was 2 years ago. So, I mean, they're definitely still making them. So I've got one more question before I start to break it all down. We can talk about the series. So you know that they started in 1992, right? And now we are, 32 years later, roughly?
Yeah.
In 32 years, between main series games spinoffs and remake/anthologies, this is not including Smash Brothers. We're going to take that out of this.
Okay.
So games that are Kirby branded games, how many do you think there have been in 32 years?
20.
More.
Damn. How many more? 30.
More.
Fuck. 40?
Not quite.
Okay.
Not quite. There have been 38 games in 32 years. I had no idea.
That's insane.
I had no idea whatsoever. I mean, I don't know any other way to put it. I realize that I'm not a Kirby fan, right? I mean, I never played one before now, and so games for Kirby obviously are marketed to me, but like, I had no idea.
I did not know.
There is a lot of Kirby out there. That is just insane to think of. So Kirby's Dream Land in 92 gave way to a sequel, Kirby's Adventure, for the Nintendo in 1993. And Kirby's Dream Land 2 came to the Game Boy in 95. Dream Land 3 came to the Super Nintendo in 1997. So it survived through that era, right? The 8-bit, 16-bit era. And then it went somewhat 3D. I mean, it switched to 3D like everything else, but it was kind of a blend between 2D art and 3D art on the N64. That would have been called Kirby 64, the Crystal Shards. And the Crystal Shards, basically you could like merge characters together. You know, Kirby could ride piggyback while another character could blow up obstacles with a hammer, so there were fun things there. They got a Metroidvania Kirby game. I didn't even know this existed.
I knew about that.
There's a Metroidvania Kirby game called Kirby and the Amazing Mirror, which was a Game Boy Advance game that was released in 2004. We got Kirby's Squeak Squad for the Nintendo DS in 2006, Return to Dreamland for the Wii in 2011, Kirby Triple Deluxe for the 3DS in 2014, and then a second game for the 3DS called Kirby Planet Robobot in 2016, and then it came to the current generation in the Switch in 2018 for Kirby Star Allies. And then it finally got the first like true 3D game in the main series 2 years ago in 2022 with Kirby Forgotten Lands. Forgotten Land, period. Not multiple.
Oh, I thought he forgot all the lands.
I know, he definitely
just forgot like the lands. Me when I build a magic deck.
But there's one thing that's interesting about this, right?
What's that?
So Nintendo is, I mean, obviously Nintendo's known for milking a franchise. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
No, stop. Come on.
Once they have something that works, they stick with it, right?
No, it's nope, so, not at all.
It's so funny that there exists a company to me that is both so well known for innovation, but also so well known for milking franchises at the exact same time. Because literally, I'd say that's a really apt description of Nintendo, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would have to agree.
I mean, like, there is no other video game company that innovates like Nintendo does, but god dog it, do they just sit on anything that makes money, and they get as much of it as they possibly can. Good for them. I mean, they've been around forever. They're a great company, you know?
For sure.
Up until the last main series game, Kirby Forgotten Land, in March of 2022, the first game in the series, Kirby's Dream Land, was indeed the best-selling game in the franchise. So think about that. They kept making them, even though the first one sold the best. Like, you'd think that they'd want to see some growth, or growth, or maybe some growth. I don't know.
No, that wouldn't make sense, Dave.
No, that wouldn't make sense at all.
No, you just got to go for it.
You do have to go through it. Now, the one thing about Nintendo that we know is that they certainly, like, all these franchises innovate when they do, right? So, like, the Nintendo 64 brought 3D graphics, and the touch-based gameplay of the DS obviously brought that. There were various games like Canvas Curse, where you would draw with a stylus. That was a game. The mainland for the DS, Squeak Squad, used the stylus to store items, and that's how you would copy things. And that one, there were party games in there, like Superstar, which was, they brought mini games to it, stuff like that. So, I mean, they definitely, like, they as they innovate, their series innovate, which is probably why they're able to keep these franchises alive for as long as they do, because they keep getting fresh remakes as Nintendo innovates technology. Fair?
I'd say fair.
Yeah, I'd say fair too, because we got the Wii, and now we've got the Switch. We can be portable and non-portable. And that sounded boring at first, but it's like the coolest innovation ever.
Yeah, honestly, you'd be playing a game and then you got to go like stir dinner or something. Yeah. You just pop the console out, take it with you.
And now we have Steam Decks. So like, you know, PCs are doing the same thing. Everyone likes the ability to play. I mean, that's my favorite thing about gaming right now, is that I can pretty much take a game from my computer to my Xbox to a Steam Deck to like my phone, and it's the same game, same save, same character, same everything. Like, the fact that we now have single gaming ecosystems is one of my favorite innovations of modern gaming.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible.
It's so freaking cool that you can just play the same thing everywhere. Play the same thing everywhere. And I hope they never, ever give that up whatsoever, because I love it. I do.
I agree with you, Dave.
So those are all the mainland games in the series, basically. And there have been plenty of spinoffs in the meantime. You know, right from the get-go, Kirby became a pinball in 93 with Pinball Land. A golf ball with Kirby's Dream Course in 94. They made a Breakout clone. We did a whole episode on Breakout. That's the episode that has Steve Jobs in it. Go check it out if you're curious how Steve Jobs and gaming goes together. Look at our Breakout episode. But they made a Breakout clone of Kirby called Kirby Block Ball, which released in 1995. There have been a ton of Kirby puzzle variants, like Kirby Avalanche in 95, Star Stacker in 97, Tilt and Tumble in 2000. There have been racing games like Kirby's Air Ride in 2003, and then a whole bunch of platformers that really just weren't part of the main series, like Mass Attack, Kirby Rainbow Curse, and of course Kirby's Epic Yarn, which I'd like to play. It has a really cute art style, but I've never gotten around to it. The point is that the Kirby series for the last 32 years has been everywhere. And then, of course, now we'll circle back to it. Something that we talked about last week with the guys when we were talking about Fire Emblem. There's no doubt that the inclusion of Kirby into the Smash Brothers series has helped keep Kirby relevant all these years. Maybe not to the same extent that Fire Emblem has stayed relevant, because Smash Bros. Is probably one of the only ways it came to stateside, you know? And I don't feel like Kirby had that problem. But I do think that characters that are in the Smash Bros. Series get a lot of leeway with, like, in terms of not falling out of the gaming culture, because Smash Bros. Keeps them in, even when they're not. Because there have been some gaps where they haven't made Kirby games, right? But people still know who Kirby is, and people still love Kirby. That's never changed in 32 years, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
That's fair. So Kirby's fantastic, you know, and its developer, Hell Laboratories, we know that they're still at it because they're still making all the games in the Kirby series. They made all the recent entries in the Kirby series. Kirby's creator, Masahiro Sakurai, hasn't worked on a Kirby game since 2004, but Sakurai is still an incredibly important figure in the gaming industry. And why is that, Rob?
I don't know, Dave. Why is that?
Because he created the Smash Brothers franchise, bringing it around.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, he did the thing.
Yeah, he did the thing. So he left and he creates Smash Brothers now, which of course has Kirby in it. Among Roy and Marth and every Nintendo character, and then some. Sonic. Who else is in it that's not Nintendo nowadays? Lots of characters, right?
Steve.
Who's Steve?
You should know, you were playing Minecraft earlier.
Oh, I was playing Minecraft earlier. Crap.
Did you say Snake?
I did not say Snake. Snake's,
yeah,
a good
Snake's
one.
In there.
Yeah. So Sakurai is still working on Smash Brothers. He's still doing Nintendo plenty of favors, even though he's not working on a Kirby game. And you know, the guy that hired him into that, Satoru Iwata, well, we've covered him too. He later became the president of Nintendo, and he held that position for a long, long, long time, right up until he passed away in 2015. So, needless to say, Kirby's Dream Land was the beginning of a lot of things, right? It was the beginning of a franchise that lasted 32 years. It was a nice notch on the resume for Iwata, who became even more influential in the gaming industry when he took over one of the most influential companies in the gaming industry. And it gave a really young start out in the gaming industry in Sakurai, Masahiro Sakurai. It gave him his start, right? And right. Helped him down a path to continue this series and create Smash Brothers, which Smash Brothers is arguably a very influential game in the fighting genre, in the esports world. And I would argue, you know, now that we've done it for 2 weeks, really influential in keeping characters at the front of people's minds, even when their series aren't as relevant. So
you got that right, Dave.
Kirby is a very important place. You should go back and play it. Like I said, it's 45 minutes to an hour. It's not a big investment. You can Google it, and I'm sure you'll find ways to play it. Well, on that note, like I said, we've done episodes on Smash. We've done episodes on, talked about Sakurai, Iwata before. A lot of fantastic history to cover there in other episodes, which of course you can do so by going to the archives on our website at www.memorycardlane.com. Rob, what else can people do on our website?
Well, Dave, you can find a calendar of our future episodes. You can find a link to our Discord server where you can come talk with Dave and I. You can find a link to our Patreon where you can help support us and get access to the unedited and ad-free versions of all of our episodes. and you can also find links to our social media, where I am on several platforms as Rob_O_Raptor and Dave.
I can be found on various platforms as David is Wrong. Each week, we tell you a story relevant to the current week in gaming history. This week, of course, it was about Kirby. Sometimes it's about games. Sometimes it's about consoles, people, technology. I find something I can make relevant to the publication week, and I roll with it. While teaching you each story or topic, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. And one of the one of the best things about getting to do this week in, week out, is that as we sit down to do research for every episode, we learn things. Every week when I sit down to teach you a new topic, I sit through and I sift through things, and I try to find something like a little less than casual that I didn't know about, which in turn, I don't think most of you are going to know about. And so hopefully when I learn something, you learn something, and I think that's a fantastic cycle. So I'm going to keep it up for a while. In celebration of how much I love the teaching and learning and all that jazz, we like to go round table and talk about our takeaways each week. So, Rob, what did you learn today?
Well, Dave, Twinkle Popo and the mysterious color.
Twinkle Popo, for sure. No doubt.
I think that's awesome. I had never knew that. That was originally what the intent behind her name that Kirby would have had was. Or that everyone was kind of confused on what color. So, like, marketing had one thing, and then Miyamoto had another thought, and Sakurai had the actual.
Yeah.
It's just kind of funny.
Yeah, for sure.
So, that's it for me. What about you?
I think the color thing was fun for me. I'd never put much thought. Of course, I've seen the cover art before with Kirby's being white. I never put much thought into why that is. I did, of course, know about the Kirby name. I mean, that's like pretty well talked about, John Kirby. If you studied, you know, the history of video games, you know, Donkey Kong versus King Kong, because it was a fairly relevant court case in the history of, you know, video game legislation, stuff like that, I guess, copyright, whatever, however you want to look at it. So I did know that, but I didn't really ever pay attention to what his name was before Kirby. So I'm with you. Popopo was kind of funny to learn. So yeah, it was kind of interesting to see the origins of Kirby. And of course I got to play the game. That was, you know, I played and beat my first Kirby game ever. So.
Hell yeah.
It was time well spent. So yeah, I think that'll do it for Kirby. And before I take it into next week, is there anything that you'd like to add to today's episode?
Well, Dave, as always, I want to take one quick moment to say thank you so much to all of our listeners. It means the world to us to have you along on this ride, and we appreciate it. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, that wraps up our adventure through the vibrant and whimsical world. That's what you want to call it. It's definitely whimsical. Kirby's Dream Land. We hope you enjoyed floating through Kirby's stages and gulping down a bit of video game history with us. But don't put away your gaming handhelds just yet, or your gaming gear. Next week, we're trading in Dreamland's pink clouds for the blocky landscapes of Minecraft, hence why I was just playing Minecraft, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
Get ready to dig into the game that reshaped our understanding of community, creativity, and the infinite possibilities within a world made entirely of blocks. Join us as we craft our way through the origins and the phenomenal expansion of Minecraft, from its humble beginnings to becoming a global From its humble beginnings to becoming a global phenomenon, there is so much more to uncover. How has Minecraft continued to captivate millions of gamers around the world even to this day? Well, we're gonna explore all that and find out next week. So until then, keep your pickaxes sharp and your imagination ready, because we can't wait to build new memories with you on the next episode of A Trip Down Memory Card Lane. Do the thing.